From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Hey.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, thank you, Shirley. It's always good to be here every morning, 9 o'clock. Especially fun for me on Wednesday. I get to talk to my good friend Andrew Goss, who I've known, over 25 years now. 25 years, Andrew Goss. Can you imagine that?
Tempest Fugit.
Who?
Time Flies.
Time Flies. I remember the first time I called you. I said, Andrew Goss, I saw you on TV. What are you doing there? And you said, what? Andrew Goss is a currency historian. He's a nationally recognized expert on the United States monetary system. Two books, Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. And he is working on a third book. He buys and sells gold coins for a living. That's how he makes his house payments and pays New Jersey taxes. Wow. Mm. Man, I look at some of those tax rates around the country, and I say to myself, Andy, go west, young man. Well, not too far west, because you get to California and you get the same what you got.
Yeah.
You got to come down here, dude. There's no taxes.
If I could just
I'm sorry. We don't have state taxes, but we got plenty of property taxes.
Yes. Yeah,
but not like you guys.
Well, if I could just take the coins with me.
And your staff, and the kids, and the dog, and the cat, and the wife. You know, I know it's a...
It's like New York City. The New York City metropolitan area is a pool of... numismatics, no question about
it.
You know, from the founding of the Republic, if you think about how old the families are around here, you know, from the founding of the Republic.
The old money, huh?
Old
money.
And old coin collections. So
you think you'll be Northeast for a while?
I think I'm almost done. I think I've gone through the whole pile. I definitely have to keep a presence here. But I don't have to be here all the time anymore.
Oh, I see. Maybe you do summers in Texas, right, near your daughter?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that'd be good.
We
could play. We could teach you how to play golf. Good luck getting Andrew Goss on the golf course. He just works 24/7. So
I play drums. That's where I'll play.
That's not going to happen. Well, Mr. Goss, in our study of money, we study money every week here, and we have on this particular show.
Yes.
For 9 years.
Is it nine?
Wow, okay. It's 9 years.
All right.
And before that, I've been studying money with you. In our study of money, we try to understand how this big money picture works globally, intergalactically, and how it all matters to the people, not just for fun and interest, which it is, but also how they can plan their life just a little bit better, right? With their savings, with their debt that they create, with their kids and the rest, right? I mean, that's the deal. When you understand the big picture, it helps, doesn't it?
Make
decisions,
it does.
Right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You can even make good investment decisions other than gold with stocks and stuff, because you get an idea of what people are doing and why.
Well, with all forms of investment.
Yeah, and why they're doing it, you know. And,
I look at gold and silver coins more as like saving money.
The mother load, right?
Yeah.
The saving money.
Yeah, it's your savings money. Mm-hmm. And then your investment money, I suppose that's something entirely different.
It is. Well, I guess the big news of the morning is Mr. Mnuchin, gold in my slacks. You know, the more I hear this guy, I like him.
Yep.
He's very clear.
He knows where the levers are.
Yeah, he knows where the buttons are, and he speaks very clear, and he talks to us like we're a golden retriever, which I do like.
Me too.
I like it, you know. But he's a very interesting Treasury Secretary, and he's not the first that have been from gold in my slacks. It goes back to what? I mean, Paulson, Geithner.
Yeah.
Who else?
1869, you'd have to back to. Yeah.
Come on.
They've had influence for quite a long time.
Well, gold in my slacks wasn't even around 1869.
Most certainly was.
Yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, no, they were the guys that did the bill exchange. They mostly made their money during the Civil War, obviously, as you can imagine, when bills of exchange were flying around everywhere, as did J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan himself was involved in a scam where he bought defective rifles and sold them back to the military for a higher price. Yeah, well, so these guys have been close to the centers of government for quite a long time.
What's a bill of exchange?
Mm. Sorry, meet my sulfur.
That's right. I'm eating my banana, so you go ahead and eat yourself while I eat my
banana. No, a bill of exchange is simply an old-time, I'm going to give you this item or these goods, and you're going to give me an IOU, a bill of exchange.
Oh, kind of like, give me a hamburger today, and I'll pay you on Tuesday.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, merchants sort of extended their own credit. And then folks like the Goldman people and the J.P. Morgan people, they would buy the bills of exchange from the merchant. Oh, you got a bill that's due in 90 days from Joe's company, and, you know, you'd sell it for 95 cents on the dollar, I'll buy it.
Oh, so you could buy the bill of exchange.
For a discount.
For what do you mean for a discount? Okay, so
yeah,
say
the discount rate, my friend.
Say I owed you $1,000 because I bought some whatever. Something,
widgets. I'm a widget manufacturer. I want to sell you widgets. You want to buy widgets.
Okay, so you... you give me $1,000 worth of widgets, I give you an IOU.
For 90 days.
For 90 days. Golden mm-hmm. My Slacks comes to you and say, Andy, I'd like to buy
give
that.
Give you the money right now.
Patrick, $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
yeah.
But they'd give you only $900.
Or 95. Yeah, and the discount rate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why would they want my bill of exchange? Why would they?
Okay. Did I mention the 5%?
Oh, okay. So that's how that works. Yeah.
And they facilitate the coverage through the banking system. So this discount system is what encouraged commerce. And if people were very optimistic and, you know, felt good about the future, why there was a lot of activity. Uh-huh. Guess what happened?
No.
When they had no confidence.
The bill of exchange were no good.
That's right.
Or they didn't buy them.
They wouldn't even take them. They wouldn't even write them. And there'd be cash on the barrel head.
Oh, I see. Yeah, just give me that cash and...
Give me the money.
Let me
no money,
in,
no widget.
Let me bite in that gold thing like they do in the movies, right?
And as a result, we had these pendulum cycles. Extreme confidence and over-exuberance, and then boom, pessimistic crash mentality. And both sides were affecting, of course, the financial markets and the real markets.
Mm-hmm. How are they able to have the exuberance and the downside without the media flaming the fires?
Well, because we had the harsh reality of, as you mentioned, bills gone bad. You know, there was no FDIC, and there was no insurance. And so when people lost their money, other people heard about it pretty fast. You know, that grapevine kind of travels faster than the newspaper.
Uh-huh.
So I lost my money and at this bank, and next thing you know, because incidentally, it was the banks that were in the bill of exchange business. Did I mention that?
Yes.
Okay. So if you had deposit money at the bank and they used it on a bill of exchange that went bad, sorry, Charlie, you don't get your deposit back.
Sorry, Charlie. All right. So I don't know.
That's why the phrase money in the bank prior to 1913.
Oh, yeah. That's money that in
meant
the bank.
Risky.
That
meant risky.
Right.
Today, money in the bank means no risk. And it's really a perversion of reality.
Uh-huh. If you have a question for Andrew Goss, come on in and join us. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So, I don't know how we... Oh, you mentioned bill of exchange and me, like the inquiring mind. I said, what are they? So let's go back to Mr. Mnuchin, former Goldman Sachs. So back then, and see, I keep going back. Back in the late 1800s or right after the Civil War, was it called Goldman Sachs or was it something else?
No, it was, I think, Samuel Goldman and Company. Yeah.
And Mr. Sachs.
Yeah.
Oh,
no. Yeah, the other family, yes.
Something like that. Okay.
Yeah. So, it was a partnership.
So Mr. Mnuchin was out early. I wasn't able to get the entire... I didn't see it live. It was 7:30 my time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess he was out early. He wanted to get the run on all the news shows. And,
yep.
And so he did the tax plan layout. And boy, it
I'm
sounds,
glad we agree.
Man, it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Go over what you've seen about it so far.
Well, the number one flagship of the whole thing is the corporate 15%, corporate 15% corporate.
Wow.
And so for you S-Corp people out there, pass-through people, man. You
know. Now, wait a minute. Okay, see, this is what I want to dig into. So is an LLC same?
Yeah, well, we'll see how the language is structured, but that is technically a pass-through.
Now, a pass-through. So does that even... No. Okay, so... Tell us how that works.
Well, essentially, any S-Corp, LLCs, and some of the master limited partnerships as well flow the tax money through the balance sheet onto the individual owner's tax return. It passes through.
Okay, so in other words, if I sold some sulfur and I was a corp, it would go into the One Radio Network Corp.
Yeah, and then whatever One Radio Corp made would go on to Patrick's tax return.
Yeah.
Now, contrast that to, say, a C Corp.
And then I would have Patrick pay 15% on that?
I think so. I think that is the outlook of the plan.
See, I need to do that.
Well, imagine how many LLCs and small businesses. Anyway, we'll get to that in a minute.
But
say, by contrast, let's say you have a C corporation, and historically, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 people in a family charter a C Corp.
Yeah.
And, you know, run a family business through a C corporation, and everybody gets shares.
Joe's Diner.
Yeah. And then at the end of the year, whatever income that corporation had is taxed at the corporate rate.
Okay.
But then...
then you got to pay on the money that you get, too.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Then when the dividends are handed down to the... or the earnings are handed down to the shareholders, they have to pay tax at their individual rate as well.
Right.
So that 15... right now, that corporate rate's like 35%. So imagine Joe's Diner makes $1,000, has to pay $350 in tax, and then has $650 to distribute to the shareholders, and then they pay another. I mean, think of how much the federal government, what size of a chunk it's getting of that last dollar.
A lot.
A lot. Over 50% in many cases. More than half.
Uh-huh.
So reform of corporate taxes is number one on the agenda. And for me, it's a simple enough expedient. If he can reduce the corporate rate from 35 to 15,
If he gets 20, right?
No.
No.
I didn't say even if he gets 20.
Yeah, but you know, Mr. Trump.
I know, but goodness, if he wants 15, he'd be asking for 5, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But okay, so a guy like me, what percentage would I be paying as a? I'm just using me as an example so people can get an idea who's listening around the country. What would be an example of what percentage I'm paying now?
You know, I 130, I'll be able to tell you for sure.
It would be higher than 15, right?
Right.
Wouldn't it?
Well, no.
Yes, it would.
Okay, so I know my AGI. I'm just going to do it here, and I can tell you what I pay. So how do you do? What you pay divided by the AGI?
You got me, pal.
Adjusted
not
gross
an
income? Well, come on. You
call
know
an accountant. Call a tax man.
What I paid last year divided by my adjusted gross income, right? That's a percentage.
Yes.
Yeah, 16%.
The adjusted gross income takes out your pre-tax deductions.
Yeah, you deduct everything, you know, telephone and all that stuff and everything. Yeah. So the AGI is what Patrick received, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I paid about 16%.
You get a little tax cut.
Sure seemed like more than that at the time.
I felt like more, didn't it?
Man, I sure did. I said, how do I owe this much? I didn't make that much money.
Yeah.
But...
You'll get a small reduction in your taxes.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm. So most people, though, most people listening, they would wait though if this goes through, and they could just form a little LLC.
Uh-huh.
And right, and
transfer
then,
the bulk of the assets
and
in there.
Transfer it now, and at least you would get you'd only lose January, February, March, April, 4 months, right?
No doubt, strategies will be put in place to take advantage of the new tax code.
You bet.
But if the prime feature of it is a cut in the corporate tax rate from 35 to 15, there's going to be an enormous shift in the way people structure their businesses, one. And two, there will be an enormous boost in revenue from the payroll taxes and individual income taxes that the workers will pay.
Okay, so go through that. What do you mean?
Okay, so we get 15% of payroll flows into Social Security each month.
Half and half from the employer and the employee.
Half from the, yeah,
right.
15% of payroll.
Yeah.
That's a big number, right?
Yeah, man.
So we get that, the federal government gets that in a single chunk right off the top of America's payroll.
Every week.
Every week in cash.
Poof,
yeah.
It's gone. Poof.
And then... They get individual income tax, separate line item altogether.
Yes.
From those same payroll.
Yes.
Which means in reality that the federal government yields somewhere north of 35% of domestic payroll.
Okay.
So 15 obviously employer employee, and then another 20% on average from the rank and file income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So the higher that payroll number is, the more revenue flows into the Treasury.
Obviously.
Now, corporate taxes, because they're so good at getting around them, make up only 11% of our revenue. So by raising
even with the higher rates,
with the 35%, corporate taxes are only 11% of revenue. Individual income taxes and other taxes are 89% of revenue.
Okay.
Because, as I said, corporations have moved their operations offshore, taken their payroll with them. And
we talk about Apple and
stuff. In order to avoid that 35% tax.
Sure.
That's what they do. Mm-hmm. And the manufacturing and everything else has gone offshore. So tariffs, obviously. Did you see the 20% tariff on soft lumber coming in from Canada?
And some dairy stuff, too. I'm not sure.
Well, that's going the other way because, if you're going to be, we have Wisconsin cheese farmers trying to.
That's right. Those cheeseheads, man. They want
to, hey, so if it's okay for you to sell your lumber here, how come we can't sell our cheese up there?
That's right.
Well, because you're hurting our domestic.
We got a lot of cows up here.
Yeah, you're hurting our domestic cheese business. No kidding. You're hurting our domestic lumber business.
Mm-hmm.
So. Let the trade wars begin.
Yeah, boy, Trudeau, man, he got his panties in a wad. President Trump said that. How dare you? Trudeau said, what if we just thicken our border?
Yeah, good.
What if we thicken our border?
Yeah, why don't you do that?
So what does that
mean?
Yeah,
why don't you
thicken your border? That means,
and we'll thicken ours,
that means
too.
If you guys go to war, we're not going to take your hippies here anymore like we did last time.
I like Canada. I don't want to beat up on Canada.
We're not going to take your conscientious objectors anymore.
But fair is fair. Fair is fair. Fair is fair.
Fair is fair.
You know, at what point do parents cut their kids off the car insurance and the cell phone? And, you know, at what point do you stop paying for everyone else's luxury? Mm. At some point, you have to say, all right, that's it, guys. You're on your own. So if your softwood lumber can support itself, great. And if your dairy can support itself, great. But don't think that we're going to let you dump your softwood here and then put a fence up for our dairy guys. It's just not right. Not right. Now, well, it's been happening, and now it's just not right. So Mr. Trump is putting a fix in. So tariffs aside, sorry, we were on the tax revenue side of this equation.
Yes, we were there.
And the bottom line for Mr. Mnuchin, as it is for me, is increased payrolls across the nation. Every job you can bring back here represents, you know, like 30%, 35% of that money, whatever they get paid, will go into the Treasury of the United States,
mm-hmm.
and will help to reduce the deficit and perhaps get some of the, you know, stop spending more than you take in people off of their high horse.
Uh-huh.
Because you've noticed, right, that the guys that wouldn't draw a line in the sand for the last 10 years, the Freedom Caucus and them, they've suddenly decided now's the time that we're going to slash the budget. Now's the time. So he's fighting with a definite headwind, that's for sure.
To give you an idea how Mr. Mnuchin and President Trump are thinking, this is a conversation a couple of days ago with Christine Lagarde. You can't catch me, Lagarde. And it's Steve Mnuchin and Christine Lagarde of the IMF.
We tend to score things over a 10-year period of time. So when we talk numbers, when we're looking at taxes and budget effects and things like that, for whatever reason, we look at a 10-year period of time. It's a pretty long time to predict for 10 years, but that's the methodology. And my comment is just on the impact of growth. The difference of a little over 1% of GDP over a 10-year period of time can generate as much as $2 trillion of revenues in the U.S. So the impact of growth is staggering. The compounding effective growth is really important. So there's no question we're looking at reforms that will pay for themselves with growth. And we look at static scoring and what we call dynamic scoring. Static is where you just take the changes and you assume there's no impact. In the case of dynamic, we assume certain economic impacts of additional growth. And as I said, under dynamic scoring, this will pay for itself. Under static scoring, there'll be short-term issues.
Short-term issues, but
okay. Well, no, that's such an important point.
Yeah, boy,
because
he's on it.
The talking heads are running around this morning. You've heard me talk about this idea of dynamic scoring before, like
yes, sir.
When you're measuring inflation with a standard money supply, you know, with a fixed money supply versus one that's realistically growing. And the same thing with when you're scoring the cost of, so that corporate tax revenue, 11% of revenue, and you're going to cut it in half we just assume that you're going to lose half of that 11% and that there's no impact from what you did.
Right. Okay, I'm with you.
And so because of that, everyone said, oh, by doing this, cut this corporate tax rate, he's going to add $2 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years.
Right. That's what the media is saying, right?
Because there's going to be $200 billion less in revenue from the corporate tax side.
Mm-hmm.
Over 10 years, $200 billion times 10, hey, what do you know?
Yeah.
$2
trillion
bucks.
Yeah.
So, but what Mr. Mnuchin is saying is with dynamic scoring, which these clowns don't use, you say, but by doing this, we're going to increase payroll 4%, 5%. He was talking about greater than 1% growth. I want to see like 3 and 4% growth in the domestic economy, 5%, 6% growth. And then you'll see revenue flows into the Treasury. They'll be talking surplus again. What are we going to do with the surplus? You remember that nonsense under Bill Clinton?
Yeah.
If he would have just taken that money and paid off the national debt or paid down the national debt or paid back the Social Security Trust Fund, we wouldn't be in this mess today. So I understand the argument of the Freedom Caucus is you can't keep running half a trillion to a trillion-dollar deficits each year and keep adding to the debt.
Sure. Yeah, so, but the idea, if you get a real 15%, would be that cats like Apple could say, maybe we could actually build something in Keokuk, Iowa, because, man, they got a workforce there that they want to go to work, and we can teach them how to this geeky stuff, and we can give them $25 an hour. They speak English.
Yeah.
We can give them $25 an hour. They could actually raise a family, maybe,
That's right.
$30 an hour, and we'd still be good.
And we still make money.
And the people, and we could tell the people we made it in Iowa and not Zhongxing Chongchong.
Oh, boy, is that a marketing angle
these
days.
Oh, man, you would think Apple and people like that would go for that.
Once the rate is 15%. They're not. They're good. They would do that, but not for 35%.
Not for 35%. Yeah.
That's, oh, no. You think of that.
So I mean, tell folks what they do now, because this is really curious. If you haven't heard this, the Apple model now and why they have $100 billion. Is it $100 billion?
I think it's over 150 now. $150 billion
in the bank in Ireland. How they do this?
Yeah, they do this by chartering an Irish corporation where the rates are 12.5%. And then they build their iPhones in Indonesia, China, wherever the hell they're going to build them.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs, yes, we know, $20, $30.
Whatever, yeah.
Cheap. They exploit the workforce. There's no environmental protection. There's no worker safety protection. No OSHA. No unions. No.
They do have these organic sushi things in the vending machines there.
I'm
just kidding. Okay.
I heard that, but I wouldn't trust the organic nature.
Yeah, the organic thing. But they do spend a lot of money on nets outside of these factories because the people jump off it because they don't like the work.
Yeah,
that's real. Do you know that?
No, I do know that that's real. That the suicide rates.
Could you imagine?
It's not that they don't like the work.
Is what it is.
They're in indentured servitude.
Like.
What do you mean? You know, here's your trailer, and it's a bunk trailer.
Oh my God.
And you've got 15 other bunks in it and one bathroom.
Really?
And you guys work. When you're done working, you come in here and go to sleep. While you're working, the shift that is in here sleeping will get up and come and replace you at the end of your shift.
Really?
So it's not, it's not even your bed.
So all those, we're going to save the world and peace, love, hippie beads and kumbaya and Trump's a bad guy.
They're allowing
lefties
the exploitation
that use these iPhones and they all got them.
Yeah.
Yeah. They
the
don't know about this.
Okay, so we just stopped.
We should do a movie on that.
There probably is one.
Okay.
We stopped right there, but we shouldn't because, they make this iPhone very cheap by exploiting the workers and the environment and the natural resources of whatever region they're in.
Okay, then what do they do with that iPhone?
Then they take that $30 iPhone and they send it to Ireland.
Oh.
Where they sell it to the Irish, essentially the Irish corporation books it. And the majority
which
of
which they own the corporation.
They own the corporation there in Ireland, right?
So they sell to our corporation for what?
Something big.
Big.
So if they're selling it for $400 here in the U.S., they'll sell it for $300 to the corporation.
To the corporation.
And so then the bulk of the earnings, the difference between the $30 and the $300.
Oh, 12%.
is booked in Ireland at 12.5%.
Smart.
Then the Irish corporation sells the iPhone to the U.S. corporation for $400, or, you know, just enough to pay for the buildings and the employees and the workforce. And so at the end of the line, there's no revenue to tax.
Oh,
and so then the Apple's tax bite becomes much less as a result of booking the profit.
So Apple in Cupertino,
correct?
They file their tax return. They just get enough profit into
pay the expenses.
Pay the expenses and pay the salaries.
Yep.
So by the time they pay squat to this country.
Squat is a close approximation, very close.
Wow. Yeah. And that's legal.
Well, yeah, but it's legal, yeah, because of these trade rules. So because the Irish apple, well, let's call it the green apple, allowed to import its iPhones into the United States with no tariff.
That's the little fly in the ointment right there.
No tariff.
So it comes from Ireland into Cupertino and no tariff.
No tax.
If there was a tariff there, then that whole model falls apart.
It does fall apart.
And then that's why they could come back here.
Yes, exactly.
Go, Mr. Trump.
And that's if there's a tariff there. Now, if all of a sudden you threaten a tariff, I'm going to start tariffing goods, but I'm cutting the corporate tax rate to 15%.
Whoa.
Then the boys in Apple start thinking, do we want to hang around in Ireland?
Yeah, what do we need?
Yeah, for 2.5%, maybe we just go back to the U.S., and then we don't have to deal with all this import tariff thing.
Because there's a lot of hipster snowflakes living in their mom's basement. They have nothing to do.
True. They'll love a job at Apple, man.
Put them to work.
Exactly.
Let them learn about life.
Well, but then you can't stack them, 12, 15 in a trailer and
work. Okay. And you're going to have to pay them some
Yeah, you
some
might
dollars.
Have to actually pay them.
30
yeah.
bucks, 40 bucks an hour. I don't know.
So it remains to be seen whether those manufacturers come back here or not.
Mm-hmm.
But, there's no reason to have your headquarters. There's no reason to have your drug company out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Not if your primary market is the United States. So a lot of big corporations will look at coming back to the U.S. and bringing the jobs with them. Now, of course, the country that loses those jobs is probably going to fight kicking and screaming. And this is why everyone is in such an uproar on the left side, because we don't want to fight. We don't want to fight. We want to be peaceful. But when being peaceful means letting people just take your stuff, I don't know. I think I might want to put a fence up myself. Yeah, a lot of nice stuff you got here, Andy. Let me just take this. I'll just take that. You can take that.
Yeah, I have a little theory about this wall thing that I'm feeling better about, and we're going to do it after this. Stay there.
Okay.
Come on, if you'd like to be on the show, join us. We have fun. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Andrew talks to us like we're golden retrievers, so we kind of get it. So you can actually have these podcasts and put Burnham for your and let your kid listen to him so he learns about money.
In this country, the sulfur levels have been dropping. There was an alarm that went out to the Congress, and this was in 1932 or 34 when this big warning came out. Mineral quantities have been dropping in the U.S. for quite a while, and especially as farmland got worn out. Notable of things was the sulfur. And if you had been eating high sulfur foods all of your life, you may be getting enough sulfur, but we're not. And the sulfur content in foods is way low. And really, you need sulfur. The number one thing that sulfur does is it detoxifies the cells.
Thank you, George. George Altgeld on a previous show. He's a biologist, chemist, and knows a lot about agriculture. The number one thing, he says, is sulfur detoxifies the cells. This is pure sulfur. Very few of them are. Three prices, three locations, United States, Canada, and worldwide. Click an order, see the ad right-hand side on oneradionetwork.com. Heard from another fellow that actually eats the sulfur, a la Andrew Goss. His name is Stanley. He's in the UK, regular listener. And he wrote me in detail. Just give you the bottom line here. He heard on a recent show with Lori LaRose that a listener had acid reflux and heartburn, and she recommended pure sulfur. And so he's found that that taking sulfur is actually good for his acid reflux and heartburn. How that works, I don't know. But he says what he does is he said, I do like Andy. I just put a big tablespoon in my mouth, let it start to dissolve and chew it a little bit, and then wash it down with water. That's for the Braveheart, you know, the Mel Gibson's Braveheart of the crew that wants to eat it like that. That's how Andy does it. And I've done that before, too. It doesn't bother me, but, you know, I eat a lot of weird stuff. But it's pretty bitter. But anyway, so that's interesting. I'm not giving medical advice, but you might try it if you're, you know, on your tummy. It does bring more oxygen. And be careful when you do this sulfur. You want to make sure you drink plenty of water. It is the water that helps the oxygen get through. It's not really the sulfur. So the sulfur is just the conduit to get the H or the O out of the H2O into the cells back and forth. So without the OH2, you know, that thing, then the whole oxygen thing doesn't work. Previously with Brandon on organic Shizandra containing the five tastes.
Bitter, sour, sweet, pungent, and salty. It's similar to the emotions that we were talking about last hour, you know, how like worry or pensiveness affected the spleen, like you were mentioning. Every taste affects one of the five organ systems, five yin organ systems, or one of the five elements. In Chinese medicine, you can basically condense all energy in the universe down to five elements, which is fire, earth, metal, water, wood. Because everything's interconnected, everything can just be distilled down into these five elements. So all five flavors, as they enter into your body, start sending signals to your organ systems to basically create a response or an effect.
The vibration or the information in the Shizandra.
Right, and that's why it's really key to have an energetically vital product that has all those five flavors and all the tastes.
Yes, indeed. They go through great lengths to get this Shizandra to you in amazing quality. Click and order right on the front page, Organic Shizandra, OneRadioNetwork.com. Now, that's the Shen Blossom ad. And what he does with Shizandra, he does like the same with some of these other things. They have a premium root grade ginseng, 50-year-old ginseng. That's older than a lot of you. Many of you, and they do it with organic sake, and they do it a traditional way. I mean, it's the real deal. If you're going to buy ginseng, don't do it at the, you know, at the Circle K gas station on the, you ever see they have little ginseng things there? Hey, who knows what it is? It's red colored water. But I mean, get real ginseng, and it's expensive, but it's the real deal. And you could take ginseng for the rest of your life if you had it in your budget, and, I think you'd be a happy guy. They have the Adapt Premium Broad Spectrum Formula, which is amazing. A bunch of cool little herbs all mixed together. The reishi and the Shizandra, the goji berry extract. I just ordered two bottles of that. These are the kind of things that I'm eating more and more of these superfoods because they're jam-packed. And the goji berry extract, guys, you should taste this. And you talk about making things. Brandon says that goji berry extract has more benefits for libido and just strength and male, all that boy stuff, than ginseng, which ginseng has been traditionally known for. And I go, really? He said, yeah, the goji berry, little berry. So this is on the Shen Blossom ad. Click and order, front page, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Broadcasting live, weekday morning, this is listener-supported One Radio Network. Broadcasting live, weekday mornings, this is listener-supported One Radio Network.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. Didn't know I was for a minute, Andrew. I just cleared that right up. Okay, so I think the 15% is a big deal. Do you think, and it would be an incredible thing for this country, the whole monetary thing, and I guess the Trump administration as well, so they got a lot of things going with this. Do you think that with your study, that the president can get this 15% through the House and Senate?
I'm hopeful that he can, yes, mm-hmm. I am.
Yeah. And what would be the argument against it?
$2 trillion accumulated deficit over 10 years.
And just the people that don't like him, they're going to just make up stuff that
they'll simply use that argument with the static scoring.
Okay,
so you're going to cut taxes $2 trillion, how are you going to pay for it?
Right.
And you can't come back and say, well, because we're going to increase jobs. You really don't have a metric to show. And so, you know, again, static scoring, very bad news. It's bad news across the board. It's bad news for pensions. You know, they do that as well. How many members are going to retire and how much are they going to take, et cetera. So very bad. Dynamic scoring all around.
You got to.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh. Okay, so what else is... Now, there was another... this is a real short little clip. On taxes. Check out what he said to Christine.
We need to simplify taxes. I mean, one of the things I do in my job is oversee the IRS, which Internal Revenue Service, which reports to the Treasury. The tax code is just way, way, way too complicated. And we want to create a system where the average American can do their taxes on a postcard, not a major book.
That sounds like a dream. And how are you going to deal with all these tax lawyers?
Maybe a big postcard. You know, not one of those little postcards, but you know, but you can still stick it in the mail. You know.
But seriously, all these tax lawyers, lobbyists, people who have taken advantage of little exemption here, little loopholes there, they're going to rebel against you.
I think we refer to that as the people in the swamp.
So you're going to deal with them?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. I don't think she was too impressed that he was going to deal with them.
No.
I mean, you're talking, did you see something really simple coming?
Yes.
Wouldn't
you know, something 1040 EZ. If you recall, during the campaign, I was very giddy.
Wouldn't that be cool?
That Mr. Trump said that everyone who makes less than $50,000 a year should not have to pay income tax. Can you imagine?
The AGI?
Yes.
I'm going to just quit selling sulfur. I'm good.
Less than 50K, and you're good. Exactly. So, you know, for the average worker...
No, wait a minute. No, that brings up an interesting point, okay? So I just said that off the cuff. You know, I, of course, wouldn't do that.
Sure.
But people would do that, and that's going to... That would hurt productivity. That would lower sulfur sales.
No.
Why? Wait a minute. It would.
No.
What if there are people like me out there? They say, "Well, I'm going to only work 49,000 a year's worth."
You're satisfied with 50 grand?
Of course not. You can't live on 50.
No way, man. And I think that the bulk of those, up until they reach 50, it will certainly help them get into the higher stratosphere quicker. But I met a 22-year-old who earns $13,000 a year.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, he lives in his mom's basement, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he told me he just filled out his tax return.
Yeah.
And he owed, after all of his little weekly deductions, $150.
No kidding. For $13,000?
Yeah. It just didn't sit right. It didn't seem right to me. It didn't feel right to me that a person, you know, struggling to make that little amount of money should have to pay any income tax.
So you mean somebody at McDonald's or Walmart that has a kid, and you know they're there working, and maybe they're making 25 grand or something a year.
Right.
They're paying taxes.
Well, if they have a child, they'll get an earned income credit. Oh. That's kind of built into the tax code, a little bit of that compassionate inflation we talked about before. Mm-hmm. But, you know, removing the tax would certainly go a long way.
Yeah.
For the rest of America. Those that, you know, single taxpayers that don't have children shouldn't really be participating in an income tax if they're making less than $50,000.
So like the people over 50, though, they wouldn't want to take away the mortgage interest deduction because that could hurt home sales. And they don't want to do that. Okay, they're going to probably leave that.
Probably leave that there, yeah.
And so something could be as simple as you make 75 grand, you write off your home, and that's it.
That's it.
That's all you need to do.
That's about it. Your individual deduction, and next thing you know, you're under 50 and you're out.
Oh, you mean you would get so much a deduction?
Yeah.
And that would put you under 50.
Under 50. Let's see where this leads.
Yeah.
But I certainly like the way they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may remember in the Ronald Reagan days, a lot of economists talked about trickle down theory. And that you may hear it in the upcoming days. And it's essentially saying
trickle down.
So you give a tax cut to the very wealthy and they'll pay hire more people and spend that money.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it works exactly that way. You know, they may invest more and they may buy more bonds and maybe buy some gold and silver, but I don't see how that puts anybody to work.
Mm-hmm.
If at the same time you go to the other end of the spectrum and let's say trickle up,
mm-hmm.
Where you say, I'm going to give a guy or gal who's making $45,000 a year, I'm going to give them back $4,000 of their own money. Guarantee they'll spend that money. Guarantee it. You know, if a tenth of it winds up in savings, it'll be a miracle.
And when you spend it, well, then things keep moving.
Exactly.
The velocity that you talk about.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, to me, a tax cut at the bottom end of the spectrum is much more effective than a tax cut at the top end. So I'll find myself agreeing with those folks that suggest that trickle down doesn't work. But at the same time, a corporate tax cut, that's a different animal altogether.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what brings the jobs back, and the jobs bring the revenue, and the revenue reduces the deficit.
Yeah. Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, and the Real World of Money, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Well, here's one of these dull things, because we knew for a couple of days, I mean, we knew for a week that the simplification thing was going to be floated today. And, you know, those of you that day trade could have sold Intuit short yesterday and made some money this morning. Intuit, which makes TurboTax, down 3% this morning. Boom. See? That's how these day traders make money.
Well, I hope they were short U.S. Steel.
Did U.S. Steel go down too?
Oh, my goodness.
How come?
Well, because of the same thing, you know, where you had the lumber tax, lumber,
uh-huh.
coming into the U.S. from Canada. Yeah. And just replaced that with steel, cheap steel coming in from Japan, China.
U.S. steel down 7.62% this morning.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. It's 24%.
Yeah, because it was down 18 last night.
It was 20. Wow. U.S. steel's down 24%.
Yeah.
So I think I was reading the points on Turbo and not the percentage. Okay, let me do that again. Go ahead. But so why is steel down?
Well, steel's down because it's, you know, China's been dumping its steel over here.
Right. And the steel people have actually been...
on their own.
And
taking
suing.
Them to court.
Suing
on
China.
Their own. Right. Yeah, and it seems like... To me, a nation makes an agreement with another country,
mm-hmm.
the effects of which seriously injure our domestic, I mean, U.S. steel.
Yeah.
We're talking a big, very important American company. And it's being, because of the trade policies put into place, it's being assailed by cheap foreign imports, primarily Chinese, that are being subsidized by the Chinese government, right? They own their central bank. So they're telling their steel companies, look, we don't care that you're losing money making this steel. We don't care that you're selling it for less than it costs to make it.
Wow.
Just get the cash flow.
And then we'll create the yuan.
We'll create the money. We don't care.
And give it to you.
Yeah.
Well, that's not fair.
No, it's not fair. So for U.S. steel to be in this position because of these policies just doesn't seem fair. And then, you know, it would seem that the first defender of U.S. steel would be the federal government, but it's not. As you said, U.S. steel has to defend itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I had a theory about the wall thing. You know, I lost a little bit of my jazz for President Trump on the Syria bombs, but I almost think there might have been a method to that madness, too, that perhaps he was just... showing this Chinese guy he was playing golf with that he's got big cojones, you know? And he made the deal to say, we won't call you a currency manipulator anymore if you take care of North Korea and you know, have a good talk with these guys. And I think China is cutting off their oil and they're saying, you guys better behave because we're the only people who are selling you oil.
Yeah.
So there could have been, you know, who knows? I mean, I don't know if that was his thinking, but, and also the wall, let's just say that Mr. Trump did the whole wall meme because on the campaign trail, it was great. It was easy.
Yeah, boom, the big, beautiful
big
wall.
Deal, you know, and people could visualize the wall and all these people, you know, the right, you know, these guys and guns and all, you know, whatever. They don't want them in there. And, you know, they know the argument for all of this cheap labor. It's not good. And then he's going to be fine with, I don't know, drones, a whole lot of security.
Oh, yeah.
And,
you know
what I'm saying?
Have you ever seen the invisible fence? My neighbor has one, his dog.
Oh, yeah.
Is it anytime the dog crosses over?
Yeah, could do lasers or something like that, too,
couldn't
you?
Yes, absolutely. Drones.
Lasers.
Absolute surveillance on every square mile of the border. Mm-hmm. Entirely possible. And
entirely
use the military
possible.
To do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's right.
The military surveil the border. They're in full surveillance mode, and it'll give them good drone practice.
Uh-huh.
And, sensors on the land, et cetera. And then once you have the full surveillance, then you know exactly where someone is coming in. Then, oh, hey, by the way, Border Patrol on the other end of the phone, go to this quadrant, this location, and pick these people up.
So the cool thing is, so maybe this is just Trump, the art of the deal.
Yeah, you don't need a 20-foot wall.
And he's got thick enough skin that he doesn't care
right.
what all the media is saying and calling
yes.
him a flip-flopper. He
right.
doesn't really give a flip.
No,
and he's
he doesn't.
Just going to do, and if he gets what he wants, I mean, I don't think he cares. And
I don't think he cares either, and I don't think the American people care.
Well, not
they want border security.
Yeah.
However you're going to give it to me. If it's a wall, a physical 30-foot wall, great. If it's a metaphorical wall, great. Just as long as it's there. As long as, you can't have a flood of undocumented people coming into this country. Not unless Mexico can give us some kind of idea how they're securing their borders. You know, what's to stop an Al-Qaeda cell from, going into Mexico and then crossing the border? So we need to secure our border. We need to do it, and it's definitely a military mission. There's no question about it.
Well, with satellites, you probably have thousands of guys
right.
sitting on the DMZ in Korea doing
right.
nothing
right.
but eating chow mein, whatever they do. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do they do?
Well, what would you need them there for if China
could,
is going to bring North Korea into play?
Well, but if you're
going to
keep them there, you could have them doing their little drone thing, and they could have 1,000 guys manning the drones,
I suppose.
I mean, who knows? I mean, put them to work.
Yeah,
I've been
border
in the military.
Security.
Military people don't do much, except when they fight.
But they do it efficiently.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Do they?
They do it with sufficient paperwork, yes.
Yeah. You want to hear a story about the military that'll curl your hair?
Go.
I was on an island in the South Pacific. And every year, at the end of the year, they would take all the excess stuff, brand new Jeeps. I don't know. They would put it on a barge. They'd take it out in the water. And you know what they do?
Sink that thing.
You know why?
So you could get new stuff.
So you can get new stuff. I mean, if you got stuff left over, your budget gets cut.
Oh, my goodness.
This is what. So if they did this on this little island in the South Pacific, what do you think goes on around the world?
Yeah, multiply that times every installation in every remote corner of the world. Pretty soon you're talking
No wonder you
real
got
money.
$700 billion
yeah,
worth of.
Yeah.
Boy, I saw that and I said, man.
Well, the idea of protecting American interests, we've certainly had discussions about that, where we send troops outside the United States to protect our interests.
You think?
Lord knows what they are. But, I get the idea of bring the boys home and have them
do something.
Surveil and monitor the borders of the United States. Like, really, could you assign like a person per mile if you pull back from all the other areas of the world that we're defending?
Sure,
and brought them into back
could.
To the U.S. And
it's
just,
only 2,000 miles, right?
Right.
It's only 2,000 guys. Come on.
And that wouldn't increase much payroll, would it? Because we already have the guys and gals.
You could set up little little shacks and feed them.
Lord knows we have a generation of video gamers that would know just what to do. Here's some buttons to push. Here's your screen. There's your little toy game thing. And you're flying this thing over here and look what's up. They know just what to do.
I like it.
Let's implement.
Let's do it. Well, I got, I'm on Ivanka's Facebook, so I'll let her know about that one. Let's see. Where were we? Okay, this is really kind of curious. Now, I don't know if this is just some collapsitarian talking about this, but if I can find the chart. I saw a chart that a fellow wrote, and he was arguing that we better look at this whole housing bubble thing because he's got these charts, Andrew, that look like...
Echo bubble.
Yeah, have you heard about... What's an echo bubble?
Well...
What's an echo bubble?
You know
bubble?
What an echo is.
Echo, yes, like, hello.
Hello, right. Well,
hello.
So we had the bubble, the housing bubble. And
yeah.
There's a guy predicting an equally big echo from that bubble.
Yeah, and if you look at the charts and the ups and downs of 2006 and 5, when the, you know, the ninja markets were out there, the big short, and that whole mortgage thing started, right, which led up to, you know, the Great Recession, I guess, and the TARP, right, and the whole mortgage-backed security thing.
Sure.
It looks exactly the same, but it's bigger.
Right.
So does that necessarily mean that there is, Andrew, a bubble today, or is that just somebody writing something because you compare these charts and give guys like me something to talk about? So that's
well,
what I want to know.
Echo bubbles are a real thing.
Okay.
So if you look at the Case-Shiller Home Price Index.
Yeah, under Fred, which is a St. Louis Federal Reserve. You can go there and look at it.
You'll see that the markets in general, real estate housing markets, have recovered. And many are in their peak areas. They're right back where they were. So if
and higher.
And higher.
Higher than 2006.
Yeah. Like
I'm looking here at San
Francisco. Places like Silicon Valley.
San Francisco.
You know?
Seattle.
Right.
Portland.
Right.
It's identical movements, but it's even higher than it was.
Right.
Of course, it should be higher because there's more people buying.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a supply and demand. And so any regional gains like this, you pretty much have to... if you can't explain the reason why Seattle real estate is booming, then you're not paying attention
to things
like...
Well, because Bill Gates lived there. You know.
Right. The technical details of why that region, or same with, you know, San Francisco with all of its high-tech industry booming, you know, and investment from those high-tech industries.
But, Andrew, if we're looking at Case-Shiller in San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, and you go back to 1980,
yep.
It's a steady, slow growth, nice and easy peasy, all the way up to the right. It's just about 45 degrees. It's a beautiful thing.
Right.
But then you get up to 2006.
And it plunges.
And it plunges down like a V.
Mm-hmm.
And then now it's going
back to where it was.
Back to where it was. So that's not necessarily a bubble.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So I just want to understand this.
Exactly. My point.
Okay.
And as much as I see problems in the real estate market, generally through the inability of people to pay what is required to get a house, right?
Right. Oh, because of the down payment and such, yeah?
And the cost.
And the cost,
yeah. You get a house in San Francisco, you'd be ready to spend $1 million.
Yeah, and of course.
If you don't have $1 million, you can't even get like a simple house.
Yeah, right.
And so for many people, this simply prices them out of the single-family housing market. But where do they go? They don't move into a tent in the park.
No.
Right? They get into... you know, leases and into renting and maybe perhaps shared ownership or whatever.
Or you could live in back of your Tesla, just sleep in the back seat. Right.
You're going to live somewhere. The bigger concern to me is, of course, the mortgage-backed securities industry and mortgage-backed securities market. If you have your Google up, let's pull up the H41 release.
Our faith. H41 release. Got to put a space in there.
Oh, yeah, right.
I got it. Okay.
And we're going to look at that.
We're
going to
go right to the Fed's books.
Yes, because we like that.
Transparency here. We go to source material. Factors affecting. Okay, I didn't get the release. Hold on. Let me see. I got it. Okay. Show me
and
where I'm going here.
It's up at the top. It's bank reserve, reserve bank credit.
I see it.
And then you see
$4.4 trillion.
U.S. Treasury securities.
2.5 trillion.
Okay. And so roughly, let's call it half, because it's pretty close to half of the securities that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York holds are U.S. Treasury securities. They're bills,
which are like,
bonds, notes, T-bills, et cetera.
That the Treasury owes the bankers.
Yeah. The Federal Reserve Bank owns that IOU, and it's sitting in their vault.
So they
it's
owe
part
it to
of
Goldman,
the national debt.
They owe it to Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan. That's who they own it to. Okay. Let's be clear about that. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. So recently we've heard the Fed talk about easing themselves out of the market, right? Reducing their balance sheet.
Correct. So they got 4.4 they got to maybe get rid of.
Yeah.
Kind of.
But let's see how they're doing so far.
Okay.
So from last year, it looks like they've added What? So there's three columns across the top, the week ending now, the week ending last, and the week, and the third column is change from a year ago.
Gotcha.
And so that third column, if it's a minus, then it went down from a year ago. And if it's a plus, it went up from a year ago.
It's 3 billion. No, so three billion.
So they've added over the last year another $3 billion in Treasury securities to their balance sheet.
That's not a lot.
It's not. They were doing it. Wow, what was the pace during the crisis? It was like $90 billion a month, right?
Only $3 billion. I mean, out of all the money, let me be clear. Out of all the money that the Gov, the one we love, borrowed between today and a year ago, the private Federal Reserve only bought $3 billion of it?
Plus $3 billion. $3 billion more than they had last year in total. During the course of the year, every 3 months, we had bills come due.
How do we know how much they bought over the last year?
Well, we go down to that maturities chart on the bottom, but it's... We've looked at that before. For purposes of this discussion, we're talking about the housing bubble.
Okay.
And so we're going to jump off of the U.S. Treasury securities line, and we're going to jump on to the two lines down because we have the Fannie, Freddie, right, federal agency, Sallie Mae, student loans, et cetera. That's all in the federal agency debt securities.
I got it.
Right. And then the one below that.
13 trillion.
Yeah.
The one below. No, I'm sorry, not 13 billion. Okay, sorry.
The one below that.
Mortgage-backed securities.
Yes. How are we doing there from a year ago?
I don't know. I mean, right now we have a total of $1.7 trillion.
Okay. And a year ago. That's right.
That's a lot of them.
$20 billion more than we had last year at this time.
Correct.
Here's my point.
Wow. How do you remember these numbers? Okay, 19 point. He doesn't even have this in front of him.
Because this one is important.
Okay.
Right? The mortgage-backed securities side of the market that the Fed has on their balance sheet is growing. Now, the argument being, if all of these banks are creating these mortgage-backed securities by issuing mortgages, then bundling them into securities,
and
then selling them to the Fed, the ultimate buyer in the past was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, remember?
Yeah.
And the mortgage-backed securities that were packed into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ultimately busted those institutions, and Congress had to step in, right? And
they went belly up.
Yes. Now, could the Fed go belly up as a result of mortgage-backed securities?
No, because they created the money to buy them. What do they care?
That's right. That's right. But and as long as we see that number on the increase, then we know that it's business as usual. Not only have they not stopped buying mortgage-backed securities, but they have $20 billion more now than they did last year at this time.
Good for them. Okay, folks, so this is fun. So you know what they always say, you don't want to see how a sausage is made. But Andrew now is going to talk to you like you're a golden retriever and tell you how a mortgage-backed security is made and why this number is significant and why it bounced Freddie and Fannie long ago.
Well, it's because they are not the mortgages themselves.
Oops. What are they?
So they'll take mortgages with a face value of $1 million and dice and slice them into tranches of risk and make securities worth $2 million.
Well, good for them.
I know. It's pretty tricky stuff.
I like it. So wait a minute. So you have, let's keep it simple. You have 10
$100,000
mortgages.
Correct.
And what do you do?
Well, you make synthetic securities from those 10 mortgages. Let's say that the 10 mortgages all yield an average of 4%.
Okay. So it's a good thing.
So you know that's what... Now, normally you'd have 10 mortgages at 4%. Now, we all know that if the yield goes up to 8%, right, if they double in yield, they fall by half in price. And the same is true in the other direction. If interest rates fall, then that $1 million worth of 4% mortgages, when everyone else is paying 2%, are worth twice as much. So that $1 million in face is worth $2 million. Are you holding a bond? It's a 30-year bond. Interest rates are 4%, and the bond yields 4%.
Right.
Suddenly rates fall to 2%.
Okay.
Now your bond is worth twice as much.
Yeah, because you're holding something. Okay,
that's going to pay 4% when everybody else is paying
2%.
But interest
rates are not going down, they're going up.
No, no, but we have to understand that basic precept or concept.
When interest rates go up, your mortgage, your value goes down.
Correct.
When interest rates go down, your value goes up.
That's right.
Because you're holding a more...
valuable instrument.
Valuable instrument. Okay, we're with
you. Correct. So they're holding $1 million worth of mortgages that are yielding 4%.
Who is? The bank?
The bank, right? The bundlers of these mortgages.
Okay. So which are the same people, like Goldman Sachs.
And, that's right.
Okay, same
syndicators.
Just down the hall.
So they bundle these 10 mortgages
just down
together.
The hall. Charlie, you want to bundle that one for me?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but here's the thing. Uh-huh. If they can divide these mortgages into tranches of risk, then they can offer securities at varying interest rates.
Wow.
So instead of saying to somebody, here, we're going to give you these 10 mortgages at 4%, yielding 4%.
Yeah.
Here you go, they're yours.
It's a mortgage-backed security. You buy
it? Instead, we're going to give you a mortgage-backed security.
Oh, instead of buying the actual mortgages, we're going to create a new thing.
Correct.
Which is called
a synthetic security, mortgage-backed security.
Which is a derivative.
Yes, it is.
Synthetic.
It derives its value from these 10 mortgages that we're holding in this pool.
Good for them.
Now, we know that of these 10 mortgages, two of them are going to go bad.
Yeah.
We know two of those people are just not.
We actually know Joe down in...
We don't know which two. If only we did, we could just sell those two separately, but we don't know.
Why do we know there's two? Just because...
Because statistics tell us.
Oh, okay.
See? All right. Statistics also tell us that... Six of those people are going to make their mortgage payments every day on time.
Good for them.
And that two more are perhaps going to be late 30.
And
maybe
two
they'll
more
go
may
60. Yeah.
Make, right. Move, so, move to Costa Rica and leave the house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Those are the ones on the bottom.
I'm with
two
it.
Two we know are going to go bad.
All right.
Okay. So they divide up and create these synthetic securities and say, okay, we're going to sell you the safest part of the portfolio. I mean, we don't know which part it is.
Well, how can you sell the safest if you don't know what part it is?
Because we've made a synthetic security that represents this safest part. So that when that guy moves out of the house and goes to Costa Rica, you won't even hear about it.
Oh, good.
You won't know a thing. You'll just keep getting your same rate of return. Now, because
I want one of those.
We're insulating you from that risk, we're going to pay you slightly less.
Yeah.
So this tranche of the security is maybe yielding 3%.
Okay.
Which is slightly better than a T-bond. So, and there's no risk whatsoever. This is obviously a triple rated security.
I want one of those.
Because we're taking all the risk. And a lot of people say, we want one of those.
Okay.
But then there are those that are more hungry for risk.
Mm-hmm.
They want a greater return.
Yeah, I want more.
Yeah, they're at the other end of the portfolio. You can say to them, all right, we're going to sell you this portion of the security that yields 10%.
Whoa. I want one of those.
But the first guy that goes bad, that's yours. That's your guy. So you're gambling.
Whoops.
You're gambling that nobody will go bad, that the actuaries are wrong, that all 10 of the people are going to pay their mortgage, and if they all do, you're going to get a 10% yield.
Hmm.
So by varying the rates of return, so now that 10% security, which is yielding 2.5 times the current market rate, well, that's worth more. Yes? More than an equivalent security that only yields 2/3 of the
market. Oh, because you got a 10% deal.
That's right. So now when I'm valuing
the
portfolio.
But it's risky, Misky.
Well, yeah, but it's still worth more.
Okay.
And as I'm valuing the portfolio, now I have all these different tranches, each one with a greater and lesser return. And as I average them all together, now I get a security, a synthetic security, that's yielding 6% or 7%. And so that gets marked to the value of the portfolio. So now that $1 million in mortgages is worth $1.6 million, $1.8 million,
well,
whatever
good.
The total is.
That was magic.
And we've created synthetic securities that are worth more than the face value of the underlying mortgages. Now, before, we sold those to the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and big banks and people that were just looking for this wonderful rate of return that they could pay their depositors and not have to do any work. But those people are gone. Their fingers are burned.
Because they got hammered in 2007.
They got hammered pretty hard. So where are we selling them now?
To
the
Fed.
Well, I think we've uncovered that.
Now, but a couple of things here, which is curious. Who? The banks are doing all this, right? Goldman's
Well, they're the syndicators and keeping the underwriting fees.
The same
fees.
People, right? Right, right. Mm-hmm. And they also, it's been proven that they, S&P... And
The ratings agencies?
The rating agencies were in on this scam.
No, they're the ones that rate my bonds that make it determine what the bond is worth.
Right, but they just did everything AAA, even though, because everybody did it.
Well, if they didn't, they would go to the other rating agency.
That's exactly right. So yeah. S&P and what's the other one?
Moody's.
Moody's. They would rate these stinky MBSs with the two guys that might go to Costa Rica. They'd rate them AAA too, because that's just the way the game works.
That's right.
All right. So I want to be clear there. Who? But then the original bank, say it was Citigroup.
That wrote the mortgage?
That wrote the mortgage. They still have the originals.
They got paid.
Oh,
no, they got paid.
The pool, the syndicator,
bought the mortgage.
Okay.
So I'm a syndicator of these mortgage-backed securities.
Good for Citi, they get paid.
And I'm a spinoff of Citi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a spinoff. You know, two or three of my sharp guys went over and started a separate company.
Yeah.
And they buy the mortgages from Citi with the syndication's money.
Wow.
So that removes Citi from the equation. So this time, I mean, they're doing it smarter this time.
This is still going on, of course. I mean, look at this. There's 20 billion of these MBSs just at the Fed in 1 year.
That's right, and we saw it on the internet.
And there's a lot of other people buying these MBSs, right?
Yes.
Around the world.
Yes.
Around the world.
Yes, well, especially when you have such a stalwart leading the show. You know, if the Fed's buying them, then everybody's buying them.
Yeah.
It must be good.
They're black and white, clear as crystal. You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
That's right. That's the way we do it around.
Clear as crystal.
Clear as crystal.
You lose.
You lose. So, I mean, are they building another financial time bomb here?
No. They're building a safer bomb.
This is not the mother of all bombs. This is like a smaller bomb.
So what will happen if, as we've discussed in the past, the reason real estate used to be such a slam dunk home run for me and for people that I talked to was that, you know, you bought the mortgage, you bought the money, you bought the house, and the person that loaned you the money generally held it to maturity. And the secondary market for real estate mortgages wasn't fully developed, and so it was a pure market. So the guy that loaned you the money for 30 years, he didn't care if there was a panic 5 years from now. He's loaned you the money for 30 years. He knows he's going to get his revenue stream for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
The mortgage-backed securities market is what drug down the housing market. It's like the tail wagging the dog. I know the media tried to spin it as people didn't pay their mortgages, and that's what caused the whole thing to crumble.
But it was because they packaged these guys up and they were
too much air
in them. And then the people like Dr. Barry and others figured it out. And they went short. They shorted these things about billions of dollars, right?
Which also accelerated
the whole
and
thing, yeah.
exacerbated the circumstance.
Yeah.
Yeah, made it much worse than it would have been had they not been on the big short. You know, if you didn't have those people on that side revealing the cracks in
it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Well, it probably wouldn't have happened. It may have eventually happened.
Mm-hmm.
But what has happened now is that the issuer of our money, the Federal Reserve, has decided that mortgage-backed securities represent enough of a solid asset that they are slowly building their pile of them in excess of what it was ever imagined to be.
Well,
so while they may be selling off or barely adding the real treasury securities,
they're buying the MBS.
The MBS market is like in full growth.
But it's important to understand, too, that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who are making these decisions,
right,
are owned. They own. Wait a minute.
The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is owned by the
people,
member banks.
And the member banks are selling the MBSs.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you want to go there?
Yeah, I
but
do.
But they're honorable men, Patrick.
Well, yeah, but they're just playing
women.
Games with themselves.
Well, it is a bit of self-dealing. Yeah,
you think?
The primary bond dealers.
Do you think?
Yes.
Wow.
The collusion between, it's an incest, yeah, let's just call it what it is.
It is
incestuous relationship,
yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
So maybe they should all move to another state or something, I don't know, but reality is that the relationship between the Congress that spends the money in our name and the Fed is also an incestuous relationship.
Look at the banks, how relationship, much they give to them,
right, to get them reelected, put you back in office.
And you're about to say an incestuous relationship where else?
Just as much as the relationship between the Federal Reserve banks and their owners. So the owners of the Federal Reserve banks are also the banks that happen to be selling them the mortgage-backed securities. But, you know,
that doesn't seem right.
No, I mean, they're trustworthy people. I remember the quote of Jefferson, "Let's not hear about the honor of men. Let us bind them with the chains of the Constitution."
Good
so
for Tom.
There's like, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt.
There you go with that again. You know,
you're well, with that check and balance,
thing
with
there.
That balance in place. See, then we could all save and store our wealth in these gold and silver coins and know that regardless of whatever shenanigans went on in the financial world, they could not affect their value. They could not deprive you of their worth. And now that we've made everything into an electronic representation of wealth, boy, you better have the honor of men, because they're not bound by anything. Never mind the chains of the Constitution. There are no practical limits to the amount of Federal Reserve notes or representations thereof that can be created. And this P number that I keep tossing around, potential money.
Potential.
If the Federal Reserve is willing to take any debt instrument and turn it into money, then wow, what's the potential then? Well, the money supply could multiply by a factor of 10 within 10 years.
You go out and buy a new car on credit, they create the money. You go
yes.
out and buy a new TV on credit, they create the money. You buy whatever, a home.
Any debt instrument.
They create
that you
the money
create,
for that.
That's right.
So you people buying stuff on credit, it's your fault.
Well, you're expanding
kidding.
The money supply because every dollar that you take on in credit has the potential to become additional money. It doesn't necessarily have to become additional money, but it has the potential to be additional money. And depending upon market conditions, the Fed may decide. We're increasing our balance sheet or we're decreasing our balance sheet. They've talked about increasing or decreasing it for 6 months now, but everywhere that I look, I just see increases.
Yeah, there was a recent thing from the fellow from which Fed? I had the link here. He was talking that the next recession, we're going to use everything we've got. You know, they're going to create more money is what
of
he
course.
Said. Yeah, that's what he said.
That's what works.
That's
it works.
That's what he said. So, and he said, we're going to have one. And when we do have this next one, we'll be ready because we got the magic money machine, baby.
Yes.
That's what he said. I mean, you know, he was really upfront with that.
And that is it. And so to the crashaholics and the collapsitarians, the only way the dollar comes crashing to a heap is if they want it to. There's no other reason. If all you have to do is simply monetize any debt instrument, so, oh, you've got that bad piece of paper that is not being paid? Well, here, I'll just create the money. You give me the piece of paper. I'll give you the money.
And we'll make it go away.
And it goes away. And now suddenly the holder, as all the banks were during the mortgage-backed security crisis, they're flush again. Now the mortgage-backed securities make their way into the Federal Reserve's vaults, and they sit there. And as you rightly pointed out, the Fed doesn't care if they're paid or not. Some of them are going to get paid, but nobody's coming after those that aren't.
Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone. Okay, so before we do our little station break, is how can our listeners profit from this information? Now, you buy and sell. You sell gold coins
for a living. That's right.
So
buy gold.
Yeah, so you can talk about that, of course, if you want. But other than, and we'll talk about your services, but other than buying gold and silver coins or bricks and blocks and stuff like that, give them some ideas about their other stuff, you know, because you don't recommend everybody puts 100% in gold and silver, right?
Right.
Well, what percentage do you?
Well, my crazy person has 85%.
Well, you're
a typical financial planner might say 15 or 20. If you're especially bullish on gold and silver, maybe you go as high as 50. Anything above that, then you're in my realm, where you are absolutely convinced that this is the only way to protect yourself against what's inevitable, which is a massive inflation. And, you know, why would you want to leave any of your money exposed to that?
Yeah. So your point is well taken, though. I mean, if you understand how this game works, as you are really good at explaining to us, I don't see how, and I'm not trying to sell your coins for you or gold or silver, but I don't see how any thinking
sane person
could look at it and say, Okay,
I'm going to go buy a 30-year bond.
I'm going to buy a piece of paper and trade my Federal Reserve notes for it, knowing what you know and what they're going to do, because on the other end of the spectrum, there's no way out on the other end.
Correct.
There's no way out.
If you believe what I believe,
there's no way out.
You would not buy you wouldn't buy a mortgage-backed security. You wouldn't buy an MBS fund. You wouldn't buy a bond fund. You wouldn't be in emerging markets. You wouldn't expose yourself to any debt risk. So you wouldn't have municipal bonds. You wouldn't have Sally Mae. You wouldn't have Freddie Mac. You wouldn't have Fannie Mae. You wouldn't have any type of pass-through certificate. No debentures. No CDs. Nothing that relates to debt, where you're putting your money out, you're getting a fixed rate of return for an extended period of time. Annuities out, bonds out, bills out, notes out, corporates out, debentures of any kind out. And you're only buying equity.
But
which equities do you buy? Well, I mean, mining stocks are kind of related to gold and silver, so
got some good ones.
You almost
there.
Have to put them in the same category. But natural resource stocks, and emerging technologies within our domestic marketplace. And I tell people, think about the new things that you're using and ask yourself if you'll continue to use them. So iPhones, Google, Tesla, all the emerging technologies.
They're going to do pretty well.
Those are equities, and chances are they'll do well. Chances are they may not, but if you're going to devote your money to an arena, don't buy debt, buy equity. That's, I guess, the
that's about it.
The best one size fits all answer I can give.
Rather than debt. Yep. But no, they offer municipal bonds to people, and they say they're tax free munis. And
You can employ other tax avoidance strategies. You don't need to have the instrument that you're buying be tax free. So if you buy a stock and you rely on compounding returns, they have DRIPs, reinvestment plans, where you buy a DRIP on a particular company, and every time they issue a dividend, you simply get more stock instead of a dividend. And so then none of it's taxable till you actually sell the stock. So, I mean, there are ways to avoid taxes on gains so that you don't necessarily have to have a tax. But if you're relying on the income, then you have to learn how to separate that yourself and just pay the tax.
Now, I've known people that have had an annuity for maybe 10 years have done pretty well. They got a 6% deal, and the annuity people is actually trying to buy them out because they don't
in a falling interest rate market, my advice changes entirely.
Okay.
So if we had already gone through all this and it was 18% interest and it had risen from 4% interest, well, then my advice would be different. It would be buy those 30s, buy the long-term debt, because what happens when interest rates fall is that the face value of your long-term debt instruments increases. So that $100,000 bond that you buy at 18%, when rates get back to 4%, goodness, that'll be worth multiples of $100,000.
So if you have annuity now at 6, man, you stay where you are.
Sure, yeah. Of course you do.
Of course.
But eventually, not kind of what I'm thinking, because that 6 will be quickly eclipsed, and every increase in a quarter point in rates makes the attractiveness of that annuity less, so the buyout value falls. So rates go now to 4.5 and 5 and then 5.5 and then 6. By 6%, now when the market is equal to what you're getting, now any premium above face on that annuity is gone. And so take it while you can, I guess, would be the best advice for me. If you're in an annuity now and it's paying greater than 6%, you should strongly consider evacuating immediately.
Get out now.
Yeah, take the principal.
And do well with it.
Well, You know, are you relying on that income? Is that something that you're desperate for? Because a passive income generator makes sense to me, something that grows in value and is not taxable till you actually sell it.
Like?
Well, like a $17.97 $10 gold piece.
Yeah, something like that. Asking a barber if I need a haircut.
Right, right. Something like a 1963 Cadillac convertible.
Yeah.
Something like a Minuteman statue. Something like a piece of art of any kind. Something like a classic guitar. So these are the types of things that
go up in value, but you don't have any taxes.
But you don't have any tax until you actually sell it.